I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last Friday, students across the country participated in the National School Walkout, but demonstrations at several Shawnee Mission schools didn't go as students had hoped. Today, we ask about what happened and what it could mean for students' freedom of speech and assembly. Then, when you think of the West Bottoms, you probably picture industrial warehouses and railroad tracks. But what was there before? We'll take a look at the Native American history in one of Kansas City's oldest neighborhoods. Finally, we'll wrap up the hour with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Last Friday, students in schools all over the greater Kansas City area joined in a walkout to honor and remember the victims of the Columbine school shooting. We covered it on this program, talking with student organizers and participants, and from photos and tweets we received, it looked like a number of schools had planned programs. But not all students were happy with administrators, as reports of censorship and interference at several schools in the Shawnee Mission District came in, including Shawnee Mission East and North High Schools, and the Hocker Grove Middle School. One of those students was Denny Rice. He's a senior and student body president at Shawnee Mission East, and he's on the phone now. Denny, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be with you.
Who was involved in planning the walkout, Denny?
There was a number of student leaders at Shawnee Mission East, and many of the students who were involved were also involved in the large March for Our Lives movement in Kansas City. So a lot of student leaders at our school who are passionate about the issue wanted to make sure that we could participate in the National School Walkout and have our voices heard and empower our students to be able to take action and to have their voices heard.
You know, what I'm wondering is, was there any indication during the planning here that students would be restricted in some ways?
Early on, it was not clear from administration that students would be restricted. Obviously, early on, we wanted to make sure that administrators were clued in and aware that students were planning to hold this walkout and that there were going to be speakers. And it was going to be a program to not only remember the victims and encourage school safety, but to also protest the inaction of elected leaders in this fight against gun violence. So that being said, it was not very clear early on that administrators wanted to censor that message to just keep it around school violence. In the days leading up to the actual event, that was only when organizers were told that they had to keep it restricted to school safety and there could be no reference to firearms, the NRA, or essentially anything gun-related, which goes in the face completely of the entire movement, really.
I was going to say, at that point, Denny, was there much pushback against those restrictions?
There was pushback from student organizers, but again, student organizers definitely felt like the goalposts were being moved on them, that this was an effort to confuse them, to make sure that essentially, they wouldn't speak out on these issues of gun violence because there's the implication that there would be punishments for anyone who didn't go along with the message of quote-unquote school safety and spoke out on gun violence and the real issue at hand.
So bottom line, did the walkout go as expected for students?
The walkout went as expected for students, according to the administration-approved session, essentially. There were speakers who kept their message on school safety, and there was a memorial tribute to the victims. But just being in the crowd that day, I can tell you, Steve, that a lot of students were upset that there wasn't any call to action in terms of demanding that legislators take action to rectify the issue of gun violence and to pass common sense gun reform, which that left a lot of students confused and a lot of students very upset at administration for censoring the message. And that's something that administration is still dealing with in terms of pushback.
Do you think the administration had any grounds to lay down the kinds of rules they did here, Denny?
I understand why they did lay down the rules that they put in place. However, when you look at other schools in the Shawnee Mission District, such as Shawnee Mission West, their program includes specific references to gun legislation and gun reform, and their program was allowed to go on uninterrupted. So if the district's going to have a standard, that's definitely important, or at least we as students only believe that's important and fair that they uphold it at all of their schools. And you can't let school administrators be willing to pull the plug essentially at the last minute and hold that threat over student organizers.
Why did you say you understand where the administrators were coming from? What's your point there?
What I mean by that is that the administrators specifically told us that they were most afraid of pushback by parents and other figures in the community who were upset that students were having this discussion on the grounds of a public school. So I can understand that complaint that parents may be upset, but at the same time, you have to respect the rights of students to organize and to protest and to have these difficult discussions that need to be had. You know, it's easy to sit in a circle and sing kumbaya, but the hard thing is going to be able to get students involved and engaged. And if we can't have those difficult discussions on, you know, a school ground, then what's the point of educating and trying to get youth involved in the political system, a political system that so many feel that they've been disenfranchised from?
So bottom line, you think that students should have been able to say what they wanted to say at this rally when it comes to gun control and gun laws?
Yes, I believe that is the bottom line, that students should have been empowered to have this difficult discussion and to face, you know, repercussions. You know, students definitely understood that there were going to be consequences if they spoke out. But again, those consequences were never enumerated, were never really specified by administration. So I think that's, again, that sort of confusion in the days leading up is really what kept students back.
Okay, that's Denny Rice. He's a senior at Shawnee Mission East. Denny, thank you for taking some time.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
So let's turn here to what else at Shawnee Mission Schools is transpiring and how the district is responding to this controversy. Joining me here in the studio now are Brad Stratton. He's a member at large on the Shawnee Mission School Board of Education. Brad, welcome back.
Thank you.
Jay Center is the publisher of the Shawnee Mission Post, who covered this story. Jay, it's always good to have you.
Glad to be here.
And Daniel Weddle is also back. He's a UMKC clinical professor of law and director of academic support. Nice to have you, too. Welcome back. Jay, let me start with you. You heard what Denny said about the situation at Shawnee Mission East High School. What did you report on at other schools in the district in terms of what was going on there?
Well, sort of the most visible kind of hiccup that occurred was at Shawnee Mission North. So there was a planned program that took place at 10 a.m. that was in coordination with the national movement. But because those students were experiencing the same kind of pressures from administrators at the school to curtail their message and not mention gun violence specifically, a group of those student organizers decided to hold an unauthorized protest outside on the front yard of the school. So, after there about 100 students gathered on the front yard visible from Johnson Drive. And when student journalists from the Mission, the Shawnee Mission North newspaper, attempted to take photographs of that, an associate principal went by and confiscated all of their cameras.
And that's going to raise a lot of red flags with a lot of people here, right?
Yes, there are issues with the Kansas Student Publications Act, which explicitly protect students' ability to cover things that are controversial.
Brad Stratton, let me bring you in here again with the Shawnee Mission Board of Education. The walkout was on Friday. When did you first become aware of complaints coming from some of the schools that Jay just talked about here?
Even that afternoon would have been the first time that we'd heard about it. I personally stayed away from the events because it was a student-led, student-organized event. I didn't want the influence of a board member to be there. But I was very supportive and very curious. And so when I started hearing the updates, we wanted to learn more.
And your reaction to how these walkouts were handled by administrators at these schools, what is it, Brad?
Well, we have five high schools, five middle schools. Most of them participated, and in nearly all cases, they had lengthy conversations with the building leadership to talk about what would happen in essentially a 20-minute window, pretty tight period of time. And they developed collectively the guidelines. I can't speak to the specifics of the guidelines. I did not see them as a board member, but I'm going to assume that there was differences even between what was agreed upon from school to school, which makes the enforcement piece even difficult as well. Because if you think about it, we wanted to protect the safety of the students. That's our first and foremost responsibility in such a very visible event like that. And then we ask our safety organization, our safety group, and our police department, as well as these principals. And so the principals were the ones that were engaged in what I would call enforcing the pre-agreed-upon rules.
But when you hear about cameras being stripped away from student reporters, when you hear stories about what students could say at these events and what they couldn't say when it came to gun control laws, which admittedly are controversial, What do you think about that, Brad?
Well, several things, but I'll be brief. The first part I'll remind folks is this was our first one. We were on spring break in March. So while other school districts had a dry run, perhaps we didn't. So this was our first one in April. Secondly, we ask an awful lot of our principals and our teachers in our buildings. Today, what they're dealing with is incredible. But in this specific instance, we're also asking assistant principals to interpret constitutional law. And essentially, at the heat of the moment, in a very tight period of time, they were asked to interpret the law. As Dr. Southwick, our interim superintendent, said on Monday night at our board meeting, he acknowledged that there were some inconsistencies in the enforcement of this, and he took full responsibility. And I can attest, I've spent probably 3 to 4 hours each day at our administrative headquarters walking through with the administrators to look in to make sure that they're fully investigating this.
Just one other point to clarify here. How does talking about gun violence, gun control, endanger students?
I don't know that it's the endangerment of the students necessarily. It's the continued balance of allowing them to have their First Amendment right protected and is tested in some lawsuits, as well as managing what we also talk about in our policy as disruptiveness, because ultimately our job is to deliver public education first and foremost. And so Tinker, other rulings along the way have addressed that balance between what we consider to be an appropriate First Amendment right that we allow them to exercise and what might be seen as disruptive.
Let me bring our legal expert into our conversation here, Daniel Weddle, again, a UMKC clinical professor of law. You know, Dan, not only are you a law professor, but at one time you were a high school teacher and an administrator yourself. Do students' rights change once they're on school property?
Yes, they do. Students don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate.
They do not.
They do not. But they are reduced to some extent because of the special characteristics of the school environment.
Meaning?
Well, schools have a mission to perform. They are to educate. And they also have to, as Brad pointed out, keep students safe. Students don't have the full speech rights they might have in a public park.
Being on school property, some things are affected, you're saying.
That's correct. And that makes some sense. For example, a student suddenly stands up and delivers an oratory on the environment during a math class, it's pretty difficult to teach math. And so there are some reasonable restrictions, and Brad suggested the Tinker ruling back in 1969, the U.S. Supreme Court said that students have a First Amendment right to freedom of expression and their private student expression on campus. But if there is a reasonable apprehension that their speech will create a material and substantial disruption of the work of the school may regulate that speech.
That's the key operative phrase here that lawyers would be dealing with here, material and substantial disruption as a deciding factor. But that's open to interpretation, though, obviously, right?
Of course it is, and it depends on the facts of the case, whether it's a material and substantial disruption. Probably the best way to illustrate that is that there was a case back in 2000 in the Tenth Circuit where a student drew a Confederate flag on a piece of paper in violation of a rule that's an offensive, could be considered offensive and racist. And was disciplined for that. In another case, about a year later in the Sixth Circuit, a student wore a T-shirt with a Confederate flag on it in violation of a similar rule. The first court in the Tenth Circuit said that the school was well within its rights to discipline the child for drawing the Confederate flag, and in the Sixth Circuit said that the school had violated the student's First Amendment rights when it required him to remove the shirt. Those are completely consistent rulings, and here's why. In the first case, there were high racial tensions. There had been fights. There had been all kinds of problems, and so the school was reasonable in believing that the display of a Confederate flag would create more violent and disruptive incidents.
Yeah.
In the second instance, there were no racial tensions. There were none of those kinds of things going on. So there was no basis for the school officials to believe that it would be disruptive. It might be offensive. It might hurt feelings. It might cause controversy. But controversy is a byproduct and a natural accepted part of free speech. If what we're going to say is that you can speak about anything so long as it isn't controversial or might stir up bad feelings, then our speech isn't free at all. The whole point of the First Amendment's free speech clause is to protect unpopular speech.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the controversy that followed student walkouts in the Shawnee Mission School District last week on the anniversary of the Columbine school shooting. I want to bring in a parent who attended the walkout at Hocker Grove Middle School, also in the Shawnee Mission School District. Kelly Gillespie is on the line. Kelly, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having me.
You have a daughter at Hocker Grove, right?
Yes.
Had the students there been planning this walkout for a while, Kelly?
To the best of my knowledge, they had been planning it for a week, maybe two. I'm bearing in mind these are 12 and 13-year-olds, so they don't have a lot of protest or walkout experience, but it's my understanding that things had been in the works for at least a week.
Okay, so why were you and other parents there at the school on this Friday if this was all aimed at being a student walkout?
Right. It was my understanding that they wanted parents there because they did not want staff to participate. It was my understanding they wanted parents there because they wanted to make sure the kids remained on school grounds and that they remained safe in the event that, you know, someone came up from off the street. We were told very specifically to not interfere. We were not to participate, that this was the kids' protest and that we were just there to just keep an eye on things.
So the program took place. How satisfied were you with what you saw?
I wasn't.
Because?
I was really proud of the children. Again, these are a group of teenagers. They came out. They were virtually silent. It was hard to hear what the speakers were saying because they were not allowed use of the bullhorn, so they had to shout. And their backs were to us. My daughter and several other children said that there was a transgender student who had a speech. That speech was taken from his hands and ripped up by a staff member.
Do you know why?
I believe it's something about I've gotten two different stories. One was that it said something about gun violence. And the other was that it called for inclusion and equality for everyone.
And was that speech torn up in front of the entire crowd?
It was torn up. I didn't see it happen. In fact, I didn't even see my daughter at the rally because there were so many kids. But she said that they were towards the back, closer to the school itself, whereas we were where the buses pull up.
Yeah. What else happened?
They were sort of abruptly herded back into the school, and it was really kind of unclear why. It was my understanding that it was going to be 17 minutes, maybe a couple speeches, so whole thing lasts 20, 25 minutes total. After about 10 to 12 minutes, most of the kids were ushered back inside the school. I don't know why. My daughter's comment was, "Mom, they didn't even give us the whole time." And then a couple groups of students remained and were speaking. And at that point, my friend's daughter got up on the bench. And I don't know what Madeline said. Again, her back was to me, so it was hard to hear. But she was speaking passionately. She was speaking from the heart. And she said something about keeping us safe. Why doesn't everyone deserve to be safe? Something along those lines. A district official was there and could not keep his mouth shut. He was mumbling. He made side comments. At one point, I heard him say something to the effect of "all lives matter" or "everybody's important." The student then turned and looked at him and said, "No, they're not." So it was not necessary for him to even say anything. If I could stand there as an adult and keep my mouth shut and let the students have their protest, why couldn't he?
So what did your daughter take away from this experience, Kelly?
She was really frustrated. And what struck me most was how worried she was about a couple of her teachers. One of them had told that her classroom, you know, if you participate in this, they are looking for any reason to send you home, to suspend you, to expel you. Don't give them that reason. Don't look at teachers. Don't look at staff. They're worried that if a camera catches somebody high-fiving a student, that teacher or that staff member could be in trouble. And she was really annoyed by it. And as somebody who's studied journalism, she and I had a big conversation about First Amendment rights. We talked about Tinker. She asked about some things that she'd heard it happened at North. And I said, that's not right.
All right.
If that student photographer was out there and was out taking pictures, it's because a staff member set her out to do that.
That's Kelly Gillespie. She's a Hocker Grove Middle School mom who was at the school for last week's national walkout. Kelly, sure appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
You know, Brad, you've been listening to this conversation. I'm wondering, what do you think? And one question I'm wondering is, were standards for these walkouts set by the district for all schools, or did each school sort of come up with rules that would be designed to fit those individual schools?
There's two answers to that. The safety of the students and the enforcement of our continued policy around the perimeters of a building, that was standard and that was discussed in length. So that would be standard. The agreed upon protocols and ultimate guidelines for what took place, we're now learning a little different in each place. Kelly referenced that the parents were invited to that building. That was different than other places where they were discouraged from being there. But what I would remind folks is that we had at least 10 different events all going on concurrently at the same time, and we're asking our principals to enforce an incredible amount of emotional and important conversation at the same time following what was agreed upon by the students and the administration at that moment at that school to the rules.
Should there have been a standard set of rules laid out for all the schools by the district ahead of this event?
I would agree with that in concert with the students. And I think that was the whole key behind this, is that we as a district and as the leadership that's elected to the board wanted to make sure that we offered these students the opportunity to express their rights and their concern. Remember, we're a district that moved from an environment where safety pins was a challenge in the buildings a year ago. And today we're talking about 10 school buildings that had a walkout and thousands of students participated. Yes, we're going to spend time investigating. We already have. I know our interim superintendent has already carved out 3 full school days. That's all that's taken place since Friday. And in those 3 school days, lots of interviews, lots of discussions, gathering the information, because ultimately we want to make sure, were those rules followed? Was the board's policy followed? And if there's both learning as well as perhaps some consequences to that, we'll make sure that that takes place
too. So this may have been a learning experience for the kids as well as a learning experience for the administrators themselves.
Yeah, and I want to wrap with this part, and that is that we're trying to protect the rights of our teachers and our principals equally with the rights of our students and the public. And that's the balance we're trying to do in this.
You know, Jay Center from the Shawnee Mission Post, there was a school board meeting on Monday. What did you hear from students or parents there regarding the walkout and the fallout there?
Well, there was one student who was a member of the Shawnee Mission North newspaper staff who came forward to express her concerns. And I think she did a very, very good job of addressing the board and letting them know that the confiscation of these cameras from the students who were trying to cover this protest raised some real concerns about freedom of the press for her.
Yeah. You know, Dan, again, from the UMKC School of Law, this issue with student journalists and the notion that a student journalist who were taking photographs at Shawnee Mission North had their cameras taken away from them. Are student journalists in Kansas protected from this sort of action, and should they be?
Well, constitutionally, they have the right to express themselves. The school, on the other hand, has a right in school-sponsored speech, which school journalism would be, to regulate to some extent. And the rule really is the school has to have a legitimate pedagogical concern.
What does pedagogical mean?
A teaching concern, some sort of educational concern to regulate student journalists. you know, the fact, if it's correct, that they were sent out by a staff member to take pictures, you're talking about censorship at that point, and the school's going to have to be able to show a legitimate pedagogical concern to justify that.
So this stuff is all, nothing's real clear here, Dan. We're talking a lot of you know, confusion, and nothing's really clear cut.
Well, I wouldn't say it isn't clear cut. I would say that it's fact specific. And so, you know, not knowing all of the facts, I'm a little hesitant to say that this or that was improper. What I can say is that the school is going to have to justify why it tried to confiscate these cameras.
Jay Center.
Real quick, yeah, the Kansas Student Publications Act pretty explicitly protects students' ability to disseminate coverage of something because it's controversial, and implicitly the gathering of that material is allowed as well. What it does allow districts to do is control the medium, the length, the format, and also to prevent the publication of something that would incite violence or get students expelled. But there's a protection there for the gathering of information.
Brad, you know, going forward, to wrap this up, what will the school district be doing, and when can we and the public expect a report on any findings that might be coming forward?
Near term, we'll continue to gather all the facts that we're able to do. And literally, I know that the administrative team at the top of our district has set everything aside, the important work they do on a regular basis, to investigate this. And I know that those folks have been out at those buildings talking to students, talking to parents, et cetera. My hope as a board member that maybe in 2 weeks from now, we'll have the facts gathered, and then we'll begin a discussion about two things. Number one, were the guidelines followed that were pre-approved upon? Some were, some weren't. And then how were the policies? Policy making is our role, and policy making is fluid. And so we will continue to update that and say, okay, based on what we've learned about these students exercising the right, are our policies consistent today? We should have that in 2 weeks.
Dan, quickly.
One of the things that, Brad, I would think about is what the students and the administration agreed upon, to the extent there was any coercion that may not be really truly agreed upon by the students. So there still has to be within constitutional bounds what the school could push the students into giving up in terms of what they want to speak about.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Daniel Weddle, UMKC Clinical Professor of Law. Jay Center was also here, publisher of the Shawnee Mission Post. He covered this story. Brad Stratton is a member at large on the Shawnee Mission School Board. Thank you all for a good conversation. Good luck with your work going forward, Brad.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back here, we'll talk about the West Bottoms and when Native Americans roamed that land. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we looked at the Kansas government and the issue of transparency in Topeka. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. And join us tomorrow. We'll learn what businesses can do to create healthy workplaces by supporting the mental wellness of their employees. Well, once upon a time, the West Bottoms was a Native country. Then French traders arrived, and things began to change for Native Americans. Historian Bill Worley has taken a look at this part of our history and will speak about it this weekend at the Kansas City Public Library. Bill is a professor of history at the Metropolitan Community College Blue River campus and a recognized authority on Kansas City history. And Bill, welcome back. So nice to have you here.
Glad to be back, Steve.
Since it's the 1850s we're talking about here, take us to the West Bottoms, Bill. Who was living there? What did it look like?
Well, in the 1850s, the West Bottoms was, in some ways, what it had been for a long time. It was a border. It was a border that divided Indian tribes, in this case, that had been moved in to the area. Divided them from each other, especially the Kansas River was a border at that point. But also, of course, there was the imposed border of the state of Missouri.
How many tribes were in the Kansas City area back in those days?
Well, primarily in the 1840s and 50s, we're looking at the Shawnee, the Delaware, and the Wyandot. As the tribes that were immediately in this area. And if you think about basically Johnson County and west, that would be the Shawnee area. Wyandotte County, obviously, was where the Wyandottes were. The Delawares were further west in Douglas County and also up into Leavenworth County.
Were these nomadic tribes, or did they just sort of stay in one place?
Now, these are primarily sedentary tribes.
Full-time residents,
But they had been moved in by the government because this was originally Osage and Kansas territory.
And what happened to those tribes?
They got moved out. First, the Kansas Indians got moved west by means of treaties in the 1820s, and the Osage got moved south to close to the border with what is now Oklahoma.
You know, then French traders arrived sometime in the mid-1800s. What do they want, Bill, and what were they setting out to do?
Well, the primary traders that were involved in the Kansas City area were the Choteau family, and we have several landmarks named for them.
Right.
They were out of the St. Louis area. This was a kind of junior branch of the family, not as important as the St. Louis Choteaus, if you will, from a business standpoint. What they wanted were basically furs that could be provided by the Indian tribes. The Osage are the primary provisioner here because the Osage in the 18th century, before the time we're really concentrating on, they would have been trading with furs that they'd obtained in their hunting grounds in the Ozarks area, which would be southern Missouri, southeast Kansas, northeast Oklahoma, and northwest Arkansas.
And furs of what animals?
Obviously, the best known is probably beaver, but it would have included marmot. It would have included a whole variety of small mammals.
And what was the market for those furs?
Mostly decoration for humans. The beaver, especially used for making beaver hats for women and men. That was quite a process of extracting the felt from the beaver skin and then applying it to hats using a mercury process.
So the natives gave the French traders the furs. What did the French traders give to the Indians?
Well, in terms of the Osage and Kansas, the primary trade goods would have been basically hard metal objects that they could not obtain from their own environment.
Such as?
Cooking pots, especially, were valued, but also arms and ammunition. And that would have been a major trade good item.
This organized trade went on for a century, so obviously both groups thought they were benefiting from it. Do I see that correctly?
You do see that correctly. Indeed, the Osage, who have a variety of reputations in terms of the 18th century and their influence, when I say that, I mean that they're seen as the dominant tribe over what would today be most of a four-state area. But what they're really in the process of doing there is they're establishing themselves as a middleman in the fur trade as it existed at that time. In other words, they would not only do some of the trapping themselves, but they would also work with other tribes to the south, such as the Quapaw, somewhat to the west, that they could get furs from, and then they would trade them to the French. But they also traded other products to the southwest where their hunting ground area bumped up against the Spanish. So they got horses out of that. And the Osage were one of the first tribes to be both in the 18th century have both horses and guns, which gave them a pretty dominant, if you will, military position in the region as well.
So back in those days, then, if you walked down to the west bottoms,
right,
you wouldn't see Kemper Arena.
Nope.
You know, you wouldn't see any of the buildings down there.
Right.
But what would you have seen?
Not much. This was, at that point, a borderland between the Osage and the Kansa, who were essentially their cousins.
Sort of a vacant borderland.
A vacant borderland. And if you think about it, of what good is a swampy bottomland where two rivers come together as far as the Indians are concerned? That will wait for whites to put their stockyards there and a few other things that can arrive in that area. But it does later become, and this is something I'll go into on Sunday at 2 at the library, it does later become an area where when the Wyandottes are brought in the 1840s, that will actually be where they will be housed, literally, just across the line in what was at that point Indian country or Indian territory, before they were able to negotiate a treaty with the Delaware to get what became the Wyandotte Reservation.
So you wonder what the Native Americans thought when the white settlers came in and eventually began to build down on that marshy land you're describing, because sure enough, one flood after another came and did all kinds of damage down there.
Exactly. You have to think in this particular case that the Osage and the Kansa knew a lot better probably than some of the folks that come after.
They probably were sitting there shaking their heads at what are these white people doing down there?
Precisely. And there is an interesting story with regard to that and the Wyandottes. The Wyandottes were brought here in 1843 from Ohio, Michigan, and a few folks coming from Canada, or British North America as it was known then. And they were placed in the West Bottoms, but they were moved out and onto a reserve that they had negotiated with the Delaware for, today's Wyandotte County for the most part, May of 1844. And had they been there a month longer, the 1844 flood would have wiped them out.
Wow. So how did this influence of these French traders begin to influence the Native Americans?
Well,
that's one of your key points,
isn't
it?
It is one of the key points in terms of this early period. And what it amounts to is that it establishes a basis for especially we would say European and American Indian interaction in the 18th century. Now, there is one competing trading situation that occurs in the early 19th century, and that was the establishment of Fort Osage in the northeast corner of Jackson County, Missouri. That occurred in 1808, and it operated until 1821 as a U.S. government trading post. Manned by a factor, as he was called, because he worked on a percentage of the furs that he was able to trade for. His name was George Sibley, who operated that trading post. The Choteaus did not look kindly on the presence of Fort Osage and indeed worked in Congress to get it closed down and successfully did that after statehood in 1821.
I was going to say, how much tension was there between the natives and these French traders coming in?
Well, in a sense, the French traders worked with the native peoples relatively well, in the sense that both saw it pragmatically as a trading relationship. And that was an important component of that. But the as the Americans came in, it begins to shift somewhat. And because the Choteaus in the later times are under the Americans, it becomes viewed as more of a one-sided relationship. At the same time, the Osage and Kansa are declining in their authority and influence in the area, and so it all is of a piece.
You know, you don't get a sense, Bill, that Kansas City today has much here that recalls the presence of these Native Americans. Am I right? And should that change?
The primary way we remember them is names.
Names, I was going to say. Yeah. But not much else.
No, culturally,
which is pretty superficial.
It is indeed. And what happens is that we know very little about the culture of these people. We know very little, really, about the interaction between the governmental authorities, which wasn't much under the French, but became fairly substantial as the Americans arrived, and the Indians, other than sort of textbook definitions.
Yeah, that's Bill Worley. He'll be speaking about the West Bottoms as Indian Territory at 2 on Sunday afternoon at the Kansas City Central Library downtown. More information, kclibrary.org, and click on events. Bill, always good to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Tomorrow we learn about mental health in the workplace. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.